Hi, everyone. Great to see you. Good morning. My name is Andreas, and I work at Twig. And today I'm going to talk about fast, correct, and reproducible builds with Nix plus Bazel, sort of a high-level intro and overview. And that's a lot of words on that title slide, so let's go through them one by one. So I'm going to start with the first one, fast. Fast builds. Why would we even care about fast builds in the first place? I mean, surely nobody wants slow builds, but maybe we can motivate this a little bit better. I guess everyone here is familiar with that particular comic, right? Maybe some of you can relate to it. I certainly have been there. So we could say we want to prevent office sword fights, but maybe we can do this a bit more seriously. So one way we could perhaps tackle this is by talking about cost, right? Slow builds surely have a cost. And I'm going to look at a few of them. So some we could say are perhaps obvious costs, right? We can say that if the builds take longer, then that costs time, obviously. And if our builds take longer, CI is going to run longer, so that costs CI time. And ultimately, this is going to incur infrastructure cost, right? So there are some obvious costs there. But then there may be some slightly less obvious costs. And I'm going to look at developer productivity and review cycles, which ultimately leads to your team's productivity. So for the developer productivity, let's just walk through a simple example that maybe some of you can relate to. So let's say you're working on your project and you're making a change to the code. And after you make the change, you run your build to see if it actually works. And this build takes a while. Maybe it takes 10 minutes, maybe it takes 20 minutes, maybe even 40 minutes. So what do you do in all this time? Well, I mean, XKCD already had us covered, but more realistically, probably you switch to another task, right? You're not going to sit there twiddling thumbs for 40 minutes, so maybe you work on something else. But context switching does come at a cost, right? It's stress-inducing and frustrating to have to switch back and forth between tasks, and it also takes some time before you really get into a task again, so that's a problem. So maybe, alternatively, what you do is you find some way to work around the slow build. So you go into your build script, you hack away all the things that are currently irrelevant to build yourself a fast feedback loop for what you're working on. But doing that can take a lot of time, and then you might ask, well, why don't we use a build system that does that for you in the first place? And on the review cycle side, again, let's work through a simple thought experiment there. Let's say you're working on your code, you made a change request, you uploaded it, and then CI runs on this. You uploaded a PR, you got a code review, you got a change request on this, you make a fix as requested in the change request, you upload that change, CI runs, and it takes a while. So what do you do now? Well, you could either choose to merge early. Maybe the change is not actually that important, maybe it can be deferred until a later PR. Or maybe your reviewer knows the cost that this incurs, and so they're going to be a bit more lenient on the changes they suggest on the code. So ultimately, there is a certain risk that this can lower code quality. Or alternatively, you might just say, OK, this is necessary. We need to maintain high quality in the code. But then, because the cycles take a lot of time for CI to run every time, you just get long-lived branches, and then you increase the risk of having complicated merge conflicts or other kinds of integration issues when you actually want to merge your PRs. So what I'm trying to point out here is that with fast builds, they're important for developer productivity, because if the builds are fast, you can get fast iteration cycles, and fast cycles to test, debug, review, and merge. And it also lowers the cost on things like infrastructure and engineering time. So hopefully I've convinced you that we want fast builds. And so let's look at the next word, correct. And before we look into the why of correct, let's first clarify what we actually mean by correct builds. So let's say you're working on a project that is built using Make. You're working on your code, you notice some parameter needs changing, and so you update the corresponding header file to update the parameter. Then you run your build system by invoking Make, but Make tells you, nothing changed, your app is up to date, you're good to go. And you think, hold on, that's not quite right. So what's the problem? Well, you made a change in the header file, but you forgot to declare the header file as an input in your makefile, and so make doesn't know that it should rebuild. And so your build is incorrect. As a side note, I'm just using make as a straw man here. This is true for many, many build systems. So let's define correctness of a build by saying that a build is correct if the build's output faithfully reflects all the inputs. So if you make a change to the code or you make a change to transitive dependency and you rebuild, then the outputs of that build should reflect whatever the inputs are, the code, the transitive dependencies, and so on. And so in our example, that was not the case after we made the change and rebuild. The output was not updated, and so the build was incorrect. All right, so we know what correct builds mean. Now, why do we care about correct builds? Again, probably no one actively wants incorrect builds, but maybe we can give some good reasons for it. And I'm sure you can find many reasons, but I'm going to look at one, which is trust. If your build system is incorrect, then you cannot trust your build system. So what does this mean in practice? Maybe some of you can relate to this. I certainly have been in that situation. That if you make a change to your code, you run the test suite, the tests fail, and you start to wonder, didn't my change break the tests? Or is the build system just in a weird state right now? I don't know. I don't want to dig in. Let's just run make clean, try again. Who here can relate to this? Now, the problem here is that we've made our builds slow, right? We've lost on incremental builds, so now we're doing the full rebuild every time we have some issue like this. So what I'm trying to get at with all this is that correct builds enable fast builds, right? If our builds are not correct, then we cannot benefit from incremental builds because we have to make clean all the time. If we have incorrect builds, then we can't reliably cache our build outputs because maybe they're wrong. And if our builds are incorrect, then we can't effectively parallelize our builds because, you know, maybe some inputs are undeclared, things are going to be scheduled in a funky order, and then who knows what happens. So hopefully I've also convinced you that we want correct builds. Before we look into reproducible, let's first take a look into Bazel. So let's start by introducing Bazel, or maybe let's start by asking who's actually familiar with Bazel already. All right, it's maybe half-ish, a bit less. All right, so Bazel is a build system. It's been developed by Google and is used internally in Google under the name Blaze. It's been open sourced in 2015, and it's been designed for their use case, which is to support a very large code base. As of 2015, when they last published numbers, it was 2 billion lines of code. Who knows how big it is now? It's designed to support polyglot projects, meaning projects that have multiple programming languages in it, and it's user extensible, so if it doesn't support your language yet, you can write an extension so it does. It's designed for monorepo use cases, meaning it manages dependencies across components, across languages, manages third-party dependencies, toolchains, and so on. And it also supports cross-platform builds, both in the sense that you can use Bazel on multiple platforms, but also that you can cross-compile to different target platforms. And its tagline is sort of fast and correct, choose two. So the premise it really builds on is this idea that correct builds enable fast builds. And it achieves this by making aggressive use of caching, parallelism, remote execution, and so on. All right, so let's take a look back at our example. What really went wrong here is that the build system did not tell us that we forgot to declare a dependency, right? It didn't warn us that we missed the header file in the dependency list of app. So we had an implicit dependency, and the build system didn't warn us about it. So what would this story look like in Bazel? Well, we'd again make our change. We'd run Bazel build this time instead of make. And in this case, the build would actually fail. And it would say config.h, no such file or directory, I cannot find it. And the reason for this is that the build system isolates the build. So only declared inputs are actually visible to the build step. And then you notice them, and you can fix them. And the way it achieves this is by isolating the builds in a sandbox. So run them in a controlled, environment, remove any outside influence, and hide undeclared inputs. And the keyword you'll hear in the Bazel world around this is hermetic. And so hermeticity we can define as a build is hermetic if there are no external influences on its build or test operations. So there is no network access, the file system access is restricted to declared inputs, timestamps are fixed, environment variables are controlled, RNG, random number generation, seeds are controlled, and so on. And the idea is to help achieve correct and reproducible builds. All right, so there was that word, reproducible. So let's talk about reproducible builds. And again, before we talk about why, let's first define what we mean by this. So let's consider a very simple piece of C code. It just prints out when it was built. And now if we build this once and run it, it's going to print out some time and date. And if we build it again and run it again, it's going to print out some different time and date. And of course, this is different each time we go through this process, so it's not reproducible. And it's not just that it's the output of the program that's not reproducible, it's the binaries themselves that are different every time because they embed the timestamps, right? So Diffoscope says they're different, SHA says they're different. And of course, this is just a simple example. In practice, these things get much more subtle. For example, you might depend on the order in which the directory listings are given to you if you make an archive or something like this, or you might have timestamps that end up somewhere. So this can get a bit more tricky. So to give a definition to reproducibility, we can say that a build is reproducible when the same set of inputs always produces the same set of outputs, regardless of the time at which we run it or the environment under which we run it, et cetera. All right, so given all that, why would we care about reproducible builds? I'm going to talk about two reasons. One of them is speed again, and the other one is security. So let's first ask, okay, how could reproducibility have anything to do with speed? Well, let's say we have a simple Hello World application, and we build it with make. So we run make, and it's first going to compile the object file from the source file, and then it's going to link the binary. And now we make some simple change. We just add a comment, doesn't change anything to the program itself. And we run make again, and we find that, again, it compiles the object, and it links the binary again. And we might ask, well, why does it have to link again? The object didn't change. Shouldn't have to do this, right? Well, I mean, in make, it's because it tracks changes by timestamps. So let's look at the same example under Bazel. In that case, we have the same code. We build with Bazel. It first compiles. By the way, the output would look much more wordy. I'm shrinking it so it fits on the slide. It first builds the object. Then it links the binary. We make the change again. And this time, it only builds the object. It does not link the binary again. So we saved on a linking step. Now, of course, in this teeny tiny example, that doesn't really matter. But if you have a really huge project with tons and tons of components where this binary itself might be an input to something else, and that's an input to something else, and so on, that can quickly really matter. So the feature here is called early cutoff. And what happened there is that the build system noticed that the linking action was previously run with the same exact inputs. The output is already cached, so we don't need to link again. We can just reuse the output. And the way Bazel does this is by using the content hash of the inputs to determine whether the action was already run. And since we're using the content hash, for this to work, our builds have to be reproducible. So with this optimization in mind, reproducible builds enable faster builds by enabling early cutoff. And also, now if our builds are reproducible like this, we can efficiently make use of distributed caching, right? If something was built reproducibly on a different machine, you know, the inputs are going to be the same across machines, so we can benefit from this. And overall, this enables faster builds. I had also mentioned security. For that, I'm just going to quote the Reproducible Builds project, which is a great resource, especially if you want to make your build actions reproducible. Take a look. They have a huge list of very good recommendations. So what they say is that reproducible builds allow verification that no vulnerabilities or backdoors have been introduced during the compilation process. So essentially, if the builds are reproducible, that enables independent verification that a binary was really produced from a given set of source code. So what would this workflow look like, for example? Let's say we have some upstream project that we want to verify. Upstream runs their CI to produce the build artifacts, the release artifacts. So we, as the user or person who wants to verify, we download the code onto our own machine. We run the build locally, and then we just hash the upstream release artifact. We hash our own artifact that we just built. If the hashes are identical, then it's all good. If the hashes are not identical, well, we don't really know. Maybe it's bad. Maybe the build is just not reproducible. Who knows? So for this scheme to really work, it requires bitwise reproducible builds. Okay, so hopefully I've managed to also convince you that we want reproducible builds. So let's get back into Bazel. So we've already covered some of Bazel. So what does Bazel all support? Bazel supports a remote cache. Bazel supports distributed builds or remote execution. It supports early cutoff that we already spoke about. And to do all that, it uses content addressed storage for caching and to identify identical inputs. It does all that with a goal to provide fast builds, and that relies on builds being correct and reproducible. And it tries to enforce this somewhat by isolating the builds via sandboxing. Or does it? Well, let's take a look at a concrete example again. So let's say we're working on some project that is built by Bazel, and we have a new joiner in the team. And what do they do on the first day? Well, they're first going to check out the code, then they're going to run the build, and they encounter a linker error. That's unfortunate. So some missing symbols error. So they ask a colleague, and the colleague says, oh, yeah, sorry, that's not in the docs, but you need to install this system library on your system first. Apologies. OK, that's annoying, but whatever. So our new joiner installs that system library, runs the build again. This time it passes. They run the tests, and the tests fail. OK, so they go back to their colleague, and the colleague says, ah, yes, sorry. You need that very specific version of that system library because they changed something in their behavior last year, and you know. OK, no problem. Our new joiner goes back, upgrades the system library to the right version, runs the build again, and nothing changes. The build system says, your build is up to date. I don't need to do anything. OK. So that's unfortunate. We didn't declare our system dependency explicitly. So the build system didn't know that it was an input that needed to be taken into account. And so it didn't know to invalidate the build. So we have to force clean. And essentially, we're back to make a clean situation. So what's the problem here? Well, the problem is that we have an implicit dependency. The presence of the system library is not checked by Bazel, so the build is not hermetic there. It's also that the version of the system library is not controlled by Bazel, so the build is not reproducible in that sense. And since the dependency is implicit, the change is not noticed by the build system, so the build is also not correct. All right. So what went wrong in this case? As I said, Bazel does have a sandbox to isolate the builds, but the sandbox is somewhat lenient when it comes to system dependencies. It's not going to exclude things like user bin, user lib, and so on. So there, it's the responsibility of the rule author and the person setting up the build system to make sure that everything is really hermetic with respect to those things. So if we use Bazel alone, we must be vigilant to configure our tool chains so that they don't look into this kind of global state. Illegitimately. Ideally, we Bazelify all our third-party dependencies so that if any one of you has ever gone into trying to build some complicated third-party C++ library in Bazel, that can be a little bit involved. We also need to make sure that we explicitly import any other kinds of pre-built system dependencies. But that's still somewhat partial since we still need to remember to install them with the system package manager. And the way this is often done in practice with Bazel is to enforce a homogeneous IT environment. Every developer runs the same machine, the same OS version, everything. Okay. And sometimes this is done by just having a dev container to establish exactly that. But that's not ideal. Let's sort of go on a brief tangent about Docker. So Docker is said to be reproducible, but that's only really true so long as you use the exact same image, right? But what defines that image is a Docker file. And if you need to make a teeny tiny tweak to that Docker file and then rebuild the image from that, in many, many Docker files, you find a line like apt update or something like that in there. So every time you run it, it's going to be something else. So it's not really reproducible in that sense. And it's also somewhat coarse-grained, since when you change something in your either dev container or homogeneous environment, the build system doesn't exactly trace all those system dependencies. So effectively, you have to force a completely clean build to make sure that really everything is consistent with the state of the system. So is there a better solution? Well, fortunately, there is one more name on that title slide that we haven't talked about yet. So Nix. And let's do a brief introduction of Nix. Those of you who have seen Xeas Yasuo's talk just before this one have already gotten an excellent overview of what it is, but I'll briefly go over it again. So Nix is a project that's been around for a while. It was created in 2003 by Elko Dolstra. And it is a couple of things. One thing that it is a configuration language called Nix. And the way it's used for build system or package management use cases is through this observation that we can see a package as a pure function from its dependencies as arguments to that function to the output as the binary artifact as the result of running that function to some extent. Then it's a package manager, also called Nix. And it sort of uses this idea that you can view your package store in a similar way as you would view software memory, where you store packages in controlled paths that depend on their inputs, and then you can apply things like garbage collection and stuff like that over your package installations. There is also a package collection called NixPKJS, which is a huge collection of packages that are all described fully declaratively in the Nix language with all the versions and dependencies pinned and everything, including a community cache that you can use so you don't have to rebuild everything yourself. And it's very easy to contribute to. It's just a Git repository on GitHub. So, and then, of course, there is a Linux distribution called NixOS that uses Nix and Nix packages to build a Linux distribution. All right. So what is Nix all about? It's about reproducibility. Builds are run in isolation so that you don't have any undeclared dependencies. You don't have any of the works on my machine kind of situations. it's declarative, using this purely functional configuration language where dependencies of packages are parameters to those functions. And it's reliable in that it applies memory management discipline to your package store, so your package store is never in an inconsistent state. You can have multiple versions of the same package installed in parallel, and you can roll back to a previous state if anything goes wrong. All right, so why do we care about Nix in this particular context here? We're going to focus on the package manager and package collection aspect. and because Nix has these strict requirements under multi-user operating system use cases with a community binary cache and so on, the sandbox is very strict, especially compared to Bazel. So it fully isolates the file system network and so on. Also, the package store is self-contained. If we depend on a Nix package, there aren't going to be any other kinds of implicit dependencies. With an asterisk, of course, you're still depending on the host kernel, and if you're on macOS, there's still some things you have to depend on, but it's pretty easy to get a hermetic toolchain and hermetic library dependencies out of Nix into a Bazel project. And there is the huge package collection. So according to Repology, it's the largest among all the distributions and also very up-to-date. So chances are you're going to find a package that you need, or if not, you'll find something similar that you can just adapt for your use case. So we can use it to cover Bazel's weak spots on strictness and hermeticity. So we combine with Nix a good package manager and with Bazel a good build system that's maybe a bit less strict but more focused on fast incremental builds for our project. So how do we combine those two? We use them in two ways, one to provide the developer environment and one to provide our project's dependencies. The developer environment use case, we can use Nix to provide tools like Bazel itself, for example, or other kinds of development tools that we need day to day. And to illustrate what this would look like, we write Nix code into Nix files. And here I'm going to give an example using a Nix shell. In the documentation, we also have a Flakes example if you want to take a look at that. And so first we import a specific package collection version where all the dependencies and versions and so on are pinned exactly. And then we're going to tell Nix which exact tools we want to have in our developer environment, in this case Bazel version 6 and Buildifier, which is like a Bazel linter type tool. All right. And then how do we use this combination to manage project dependencies? For that we developed a Bazel extension called Rules Nix Packages. And Bazel can use Rules Nix packages to invoke the Nix package manager and import packages. And we can do this to import toolchains, for example, or other kinds of tools or libraries into our build. And to illustrate that, I'll also give a brief example of depending on the LZ4 library, just for example. So the way this works in Bazel is there is one central file, the workspace file, that manages all external dependencies. Now with a new upcoming feature, there is also the module.bazel file. But for the purposes here, we'll stick to the workspace for now. And first, we tell Bazel that we want to import a Nix package into our project. And then The name LZ4 is also going to be used as the as the next attribute path. And then here we're going to tell Bazel how exactly we import this. And I'm going to skip forward a little bit. So the way this works is Bazel invokes Nix through rules Nix packages and then imports this package. And in our new joiner story again, we would install Nix, check out, join the devenv build. The build would likely download pre-cached artifacts. We can run the tests, are done, and can work together with our colleague. And yeah, so we get consistent developer environment, explicit dependencies, reproducible builds, fine-grained updates. If we change a single version, we only have to invalidate what depends on this, and we get to benefit from a shared cache. There are some caveats where Windows is not supported and distributed builds only with an asterisk. And to get started, take a look at nix-bazel.build, the user guide and the code lab, or the Bazel and Nix website. And with Bazel, we get a good build system with a focus on fast builds, but less strict within our project. And with Nix, a package manager with a strict sandbox. OK. Then we can do this a bit slower. all right, so with Bazel, we get a build system that aims for fast and correct builds, is strict within our project, but when it comes to system dependencies, places the burden on you to make sure that your dependencies are correct. Then we use the Nix package manager to get strict sandboxing and isolate our project from the system and get a hermetic project. And we combine the two to get the best of both, to get fast, incremental, and correct and reproducible builds. All right, before I close, a few words about Twig. So in Twig, I lead the scalable builds group, which contributes to open source build systems like Bazel, Pans, Buck2. And we help our clients with build system migrations and optimization and so on. Check out our page if you want to see more and get in touch. And Twig is also part of a company called Modus Create, which has wider offerings around platform modernization and DevOps and security. All right, thanks.
Sorry, I kind of screwed that up. The other talk was shorter. And so we do have actually 10 minutes for questions, so let's get started.
Why does the Bazel community not have a Bazel packages thing like Nix packages, where they do very simple things of just, we just call meson in a build environment and not Bazelify the entire thing, but just call the build tool that the package already uses, like Nix does? Is that just because Nix packages already exist, and then why do the work? Or is there any effort on actually just doing everything in Bazel?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So to some extent, there is an effort like this. So with the new BZL mod dependency manager that I very briefly alluded to with the modules.bazel file, that is something that's actually being worked on. There is something called the Bazel Central Registry. And the idea is to collect mainly Bazel extensions, like rules.cc, rules.nix packages, and so on, in this registry. But it's also used to collect Bazel definitions for third-party dependencies, like you're going to find libz or libssl or stuff like this in this thing. And then on the question about just invoking the packages build system, there are also efforts there. So, I mean, with a simple example like libz, you don't need it. You can just use the native Bazel CC rules and it's going to work fine. With something more complicated, you're probably going to be better off just invoking make or cmake or configure, like auto tools or whatever. And there is a project called rules for NCC that does exactly that. And you're going to find examples of that in the BCR as well. A problem there is that, and that's a contrast to Nix, is that Bazel is designed to be much more fine-grained than Nix. So with Nix, it views the entire package as a single thing that you build, and the output, as far as Nix is concerned, is just a bunch of files and directories and trees and whatever under the Nix store path, and it doesn't really care about the details there, right? And also the way you depend on these things later on in other Nix expressions is that you just say, you know, the Nix store path resolved by this Nix expression, and then just by stringly concatenating paths together, slash bin slash tool or something like this, right? Whereas Bazel is aiming to be much, much more precise. It really wants to track every individual file. And additionally, similar to Nix, it enforces a static dependency graph. And so with packages that are a bit more complicated, it quickly gets quite tricky to make sure that all these outputs and everything are managed correctly, that all the dependencies of your build system are placed into the right location during the build. Another big distinction is that in Nix, everything is based on absolute paths, right? Everything is slash Nix, slash store something. Whereas in Bazel, the use case is one where a developer just builds somewhere in their home directory. And so we don't have the luxury of having like a controlled absolute path that's always there. And so everything has to work based on relative paths. And then it quickly gets very complicated, because depending on which directory you're actually building in, then your dependencies, if they're all declared by relative path, have to be found in the right places and so on. So with more involved third-party dependency build scripts, it just can get very gnarly to actually make those work under Bazel. And so maybe over time, the effort is going to be done to make this happen for all relevant third-party dependencies, and maybe there is going to be enough of a community to maintain all that. But with Nix packages, we already have all that, so why not just use that?
Yeah, so as someone who's not very familiar with Nix OS, I just wanted to ask a quick question about the version pinning, and you probably get that question a lot, but I think like the general doubt about version pinning is always that it's a huge hassle to like specify all your dependencies, right? And that if all the versions are pinned, you don't automatically get like, I don't know, security updates in the packages that you're using. And I just wanted to ask if like how you're accounting for that. Do you have any like guidelines, or is there any automated way this stuff is handled?
Yeah, that's also a good question. So I mean, the Nix packages project keeps all these definitions of dependencies and versions upstream controlled by community. And you can really see it like a Linux distribution, right? It's the same thing like you're depending on some Debian or Ubuntu or whatever, and they control all those dependencies and the versions. But you get to pick exactly which collection of versions you want to refer to. And then on top of that, you can make modifications to those. You can make overlays or overrides to change individual versions of packages that you, in your use case, need a different version from. And then this is going to be injected into the transitive dependency graph if you want, so that other system packages depending on those also are consistent with that version. It is true that if your needs of versions differ significantly from what the upstream Nix packages package set has, you may need to maintain a relatively large set of overrides or patches or whatever to make sure that that is consistent. That can be a bit of work. Yeah. But if your needs are matched by the versions in Nix packages, then that's okay.
Thanks for the talk, very interesting. I'm new to NixOS, although I was looking at it for quite some time. Now I have two questions. One about Bazel, it seems like it's content aware, so it was aware that what you inserted was a comment. So why did it need to compile it in the first place? That's the first question. And the other question is about NixOS. For some really esoteric packages are out there, is there something like Arch user repository or something like that where people can freely add additional packages? Thank you.
Right. So with the first question, maybe just to clarify, you were asking about why did it need to compile the C file to an object in the very first time around or after I added the comment?
After you added the comment, it obviously understood that the code is the same. Why it compiled it again?
Ah, yes, yes. So it's not like Bazel is doing semantic analysis of the source code and understanding it's the same. So the source file itself changed because we added a comment, right? So the hash, the content hash of the source file is going to be different, and that's in direct input to the compile action. So Bazel has to rerun the compile action. But I mean, assuming that comment change doesn't change the object, which is at least the case in release builds and so on, the object is going to be identical, and then we don't need the link anymore. And then with regards to the user repository, I mean, the Nix packages repository itself is very easy to contribute to, so you're actually going to find a very large set of packages in there already. And then you're going to find some targeted repositories for things like, I don't know, specific Rust-specific overlays, or some user has this package collection that they care about that they want to keep separate with a newly introduced flake system that is easier to manage in some to some extent. And I'm not sure, maybe someone else here actually knows if there is something like an AUR. I believe have something, I've seen something like this at some point.
Yes, there's a Nix community, there's an NUR, I think it's Nix User Repositories or something, and that's a directory where people can publish their own package collections, and they are accessible from there, but like everybody can put up a repo with a bunch of expressions and use it to extend Nix packages.
Yeah, thanks.
And actually, Nix packages has more packages than AUR, so again.
And Nix packages actually includes more packages than AUR. This includes language-specific packages and libraries, which may skew the number a bit. But in any case, you can just add your package to Nix packages.
Yeah.
What's your strategy to manage the runtime dependencies? So usually when we have a system dependency, it somehow also becomes our runtime dependency, especially with dynamic linking. Do you run the application under the same environment you used to build, or is that just container or some other dependency management system in prod?
Yeah, so there we have used different approaches depending on the specific needs of the use case. For example, one thing we've done is identify all runtime library dependencies at the end of the build stage when we're generating a deployable artifact, bundling them all up, even including libc and so on, and the loader, and making this a fully self-contained relocatable package. That's one way. Or if in your use case, the machine under which you're running is managed by Nix anyway, well, then you can just make sure that you rely on the same Nix store paths, and then that's fine. Or you can aim to build fully statically. That's another route. So yeah, depending on the use case, we've applied different strategies.
OK, any other questions? OK, we have a minute and a half.
Cool. How do you deal? I don't know very much about Basel. I like and use Make a lot. How do you deal with different compiler flags? Like perhaps part of your build needs one set of compiler flags for a package, and then the thing already in the Nix repository has a different set.
Right, yeah. So to manage the consistency between Nix and Basel, so one thing we do is we also pull in the compiler toolchain from Nix, and so then at least those flags that are configured in the toolchain itself this way are consistent. It is something that when setting up the build system, one has to be careful about, that you don't introduce inconsistent flags on the Basel side compared to the Nix side or vice versa. And then Basel itself is also able to manage, sort of, if you have a use case where you need different flags for different components, there are various ways to do this. So one thing is that you can just define flags per target, or you can factor this out into a macro. Or another thing is that if you can link those to what Basel calls a configuration, like a debug, release, this target platform, whatever, then similar to Buck as well, it has a notion of transitions to point to a different build. All right, thank you everyone. I think that's it.